This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Life changes fast. Life changes in the instant. You sit down to dinner, and life as you know it ends. Those are the first words of Joan Didion's new memoir, The Year of Magical Thinking. It's about the year following the death of her husband, the writer John Gregory Dunne. He died as they were sitting down to dinner on the night of December 30th, 2003. It was a heart attack. He was 71. Didion and Dunne had just come back from the hospital where their daughter was in a coma, suffering from pneumonia and septic shock. While Didion's memoir chronicles her grief for her husband, it also describes her daughter's medical progress and setbacks. By the close of her book, Didion thought her daughter was recovering, but just a few weeks ago in late August, she died from an abdominal infection. She was 39. Devastating is the way New York Times book critic Michiko Kakutani describes Didion's memoir. Didion's best-known books include Slouching Toward Bethlehem, Play It As It Lays, and A Book of Common Prayer. Let's start with a reading from The Year of Magical Thinking. It begins as Didion and her husband were beginning dinner in what turned out to be his final moments.
We sat down. My attention was on mixing the salad. John was talking, then he wasn't. At one point in the seconds or minute before he stopped talking, he had asked me if I had used single malt scotch for his second drink. I had said no, I used the same scotch I had used for his first drink. Good, he had said. I don't know why, but I don't think you should mix them. At another point in those seconds or that minute, he had been talking about why World War I was the critical event from which the entire rest of the 20th century flowed. I have no idea which subject we were on, the scotch or World War I, at the instant he stopped talking. I only remember looking up. His left hand was raised and he was slumped motionless. At first I thought he was making a failed joke, an attempt to make the difficulty of the day seem manageable. I remember saying, "Don't do that." When he did not respond, my first thought was that he had started to eat and choked. I remember trying to lift him far enough from the back of the chair to give him the Heimlich. I remember the sense of his weight as he fell forward, first against the table, then to the floor. In the kitchen by the phone, I had taped a card with the New York Presbyterian ambulance numbers. I had not taped the numbers by the phone because I anticipated a moment like this. I had taped the numbers by the phone in case someone in the building needed an ambulance. Someone else. I called one of the numbers. A dispatcher asked if he was breathing. I said, "Just come."
That's Joan Didion reading from her new memoir, The Year of Magical Thinking. Joan Didion, welcome to Fresh Air. And I just want to say at the top, very sorry about the loss of your husband and your daughter. This is a really beautifully written book, and I loved reading it, but I also hated reading it only in the sense that, you know, it makes me think not only of your losses, it makes me think of, you know, losses I may experience and losses. Do you know what it's...
You know, I had the sense when I was writing it that I wasn't writing it at all. It was like automatic writing. It was a very different kind of process. It was simply everything that I was on my mind just came out and got on the page. And that was kind of my intention, to keep it kind of raw, because I thought it occurred to me when I was doing a lot of reading about death and grief that nobody told you the raw part. And every one of us is going to face it sooner or later.
How do you think it affected your grieving to be chronicling it as it happened?
Well, it's the way I process everything is by writing it down. I don't actually process anything until I write it down. I mean, in terms of thinking, in terms of coming to terms with it. So it was kind of a necessary thing for me. I don't know that it would be for everybody. You have to actually probably be a writer to process that way.
After you called, 911, it took about 5 minutes for them to come. What did you
do? I didn't know.
What did I do? Yeah, what did you do in that 5 minutes?
I kept trying to wake him up. I mean, I kept trying to lift him. I kept trying to... I don't remember. I mean, I kept... I don't remember what I did. I didn't do anything. I mean, there was nothing. I remember calling downstairs and asking the doorman to come up. But actually the ambulance was there almost immediately.
You had an autopsy done because you wanted to know, like, did he die that moment he stopped talking? Or
yes, I wanted to know when he died, if I could have kept him alive.
Were you feeling guilty that there was something you should have been able to do?
I think everybody who has somebody die in their family feels guilty. Because most of us think we should be omnipotent, that we should be able to control almost everything, you know. I mean, it's a delusion, but we do think that we should be able to keep those we love alive.
Did the autopsy put your mind at ease on that count?
It did. The autopsy was surprising to me because once I knew he'd had a heart attack, I assumed it was an arrhythmia of some kind, that he'd gone into ventricular fibrillation spontaneously or just because of an electrical malfunction. That wasn't the case. He died of coronary artery disease, which everybody had discounted because he had had it in 1987, been treated for it. Everything looked fine. He would have annual tests, including an angiogram, and nothing ever showed. It was totally silent.
Your book is called The Year of Magical Thinking, and you realize at some point that you had been engaging in magical thinking that had to do with this genuine thought that maybe he'd come back, so you shouldn't throw out his shoes in case he needs them when he comes back. And
right, maybe I could, if I did the right things, he would come back. It's, you know, it's a form of, it's the way children think. A lot of people have told me that, who have lost a husband or child, that they engaged in it too.
Is there a point where you realized you stopped?
There was a point where I realized that I had been doing it. And yes, then I realized that it gradually stopped. I don't think I'm doing it now.
You talk about how you didn't want to give away his shoes, for example, because if he came back, he'd needed them. Giving away clothes after someone dies is so hard. I mean, you have to decide with all their possessions, what are you going to keep? What are you going to give away to friends? What are you going to give to charity? What are you going to throw out? Was that a really horrible process?
I haven't done it. I just left everything. After I discovered that I couldn't give away the shoes, I just closed that door. Now, I haven't had to move or repaint the apartment or do anything that required me to do it. I think, I presume that it would be somewhat less painful now than it was in the first few months when I initially tried it. Because now I know he's dead in a way that I viscerally didn't know then. But I would just as soon let that door stay closed for a while, until I need to open it.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Joan Didion, and she's written a memoir about the year after her husband's death. It's called The Year of Magical Thinking. And her husband was the writer John Gregory Dunn. How much had you talked about death with your husband? And did you have those conversations about what to do if the other dies and what you'd want
for the
survivor?
He was always trying to have that conversation with me. And I would, in many ways, not have it, because I thought it was, I see now it was threatening to me, and I was afraid of it. But what I thought then was that it was just dwelling on things that weren't going to happen, or dwelling on things that we couldn't help, or, you know, and so he gave me any number of, he was always giving me, also, because he did have this streak of Irish morbidity. He was always talking about his funeral and giving me new lists of people who could or could not speak, because he was kind of volatile in his likes and dislikes. And, of course, at the key moment, I couldn't find any of those lists. I mean, they'd been changed so often anyway that it would have made no difference.
I want to quote something you write in your memoir, The Year of Magical Thinking. You write, "Marriage is memory. Marriage is time. Marriage is not only time, it is also paradoxically the denial of time. For 40 years, I saw myself through John's eyes. I did not age. This year, for the first time since I was 29, I saw myself through the eyes of others. This year, for the first time since I was 29, I realized that my image of myself was of someone significantly younger.
Right.
As writers, you both worked at home and you were with each other just about all the time. Did you have a sense of who you were outside of the marriage, who you were as a single Joan Didion as opposed to a Joan Didion and John Gregory Dunn as a unit?
Not really, no. The family was my unit, was kind of the way I, that was actually the way I wanted it. So it was kind of necessary to find my, you know, to refine myself. I hadn't particularly liked being single.
When you were younger, you mean?
When I was younger.
Were there parts of yourself that you kind of relied on him to do? I mean, you know what I mean?
All parts. I mean, people often said that he finished sentences for me. Well, he did, which meant that I just relied on him. He was between me and the world. He not only answered the telephone, he finished my sentences. He was the baffle between me and the world at large.
So how are you negotiating the world now that there isn't that baffle?
Well, it's like everything else. You learn to do it. I remember when I stopped smoking, it was very hard to know how to arrange to walk around as an adult person because I had been smoking at that point since I was 15. And this is kind of like relearning you kind of just learn new. It's not difficult. It's just sort of lonely it's sort of a bleak thing to do.
Are you comfortable being alone?
Yeah, I've always been comfortable being alone. So that is not the problem. Basically, one thing that everybody who has been in a close marriage and who is in the what everyone thinks when his or her spouse dies is it's the way in which you are struck at every moment with something you need to tell him.
Right. In that passage that I just quoted, you say that this was the first time, after his death was the first time, that you realized your image of yourself was of someone significantly younger.
Right.
I think I know exactly what you mean, but I'm going to ask you to elaborate on that anyways.
Well, you know, I mean, John saw me as, in a sense, I mean, he didn't. Really, but he gave the impression of seeing me as I had been when he met me, or when he married me. Basically, it seemed to me that we were still grappling with the same questions and problems that we had been dealing with as very, you know, when we were 29, 30, 31. We were still doing the same things. We were still worried about the same things. We were the same people. So I didn't really think of myself as getting older.
Your husband died 5 days after your daughter had been hospitalized for pneumonia, and by the time he died, she had also gone into septic shock, a blood infection.
Yeah.
So you were dealing, you had just gotten back from the hospital visiting her when he died.
We had been seeing her in the hospital. Yeah, it could not be described as a visit, really, because she was unconscious.
She was in a coma.
But she was in an induced coma because she was on a ventilator. And they kept her under heavy sedation so that she wouldn't tear out the ventilator, which people tend to do when they find something going down their throats.
So you had to figure out how to tell her that when she came out of the coma, You had to figure out how to tell her that her father had died. Why did you want to even bring that up while she was fragile? Yeah.
Well, I didn't want to bring it up. It was the last thing I wanted to bring up. But the minute she saw me, I knew she would ask where her father was. And so I wasn't planning to see her. I thought that it would be good if at the time when they lifted the sedation, if her husband were there, and she would be kind of in and out for a few days, the doctor said. And so she would absorb that her husband was there, and then she would probably go back to sleep. And she would be focused on they'd only been married 5 months. And so she would kind of focus on him and on their life together. And it wouldn't in the natural course of things maybe occur to her to ask how her father was. But if she saw me, that's the first question she would ask. Where is Daddy? So I hadn't planned to be there. I'd planned to stay away but I was in the hospital. I was out in the corridor when they lifted the sedation. And unfortunately, the nurse told her that I was out there. So then she wanted me to come in. So I did. And I told her. Because the first thing she asked was, where's Daddy? So I told her, but because she was so sedated still, I mean, it took several days for the sedation really to lift. She didn't remember it that night when I came back.
And you had to tell her again?
I had to tell her again because she asked how he was, and I said, and so I explained that I said, you remember today I told you, et cetera. And I'd kind of emphasized the long history of cardiac. And she had apparently, and what she said to me was, when I said, remember this morning I told you he'd had a heart attack, and she said, yes, but how is he now? You see, she had absorbed she'd absorbed the problem, but she hadn't absorbed what happened, the outcome.
Your daughter got out of the hospital. She had several major setbacks, but at the end of your memoir, you think that she's on the verge of really resuming her life. In August, after you'd finished your memoir, your daughter died, and this was about a year and a half after her husband's death. She was 39.
Right, right.
You had just examined your grief over your husband so thoroughly in writing about it, and then it was time to grieve again. Now, with your husband, you understood the magical thinking that you were going through, this impossible belief that somehow he was going to come back, so you shouldn't even like throw out his clothes because he'd need them if he came back. Having examined your grief so carefully, were there little tricks that one plays on oneself when one's grieving that you couldn't even do anymore because you'd seen through it by writing your memoir?
Well, I didn't. You see, I haven't really started grieving yet.
For your daughter?
Right. I think I'm still in the shock phase. And right after John died, there was a long period before I was able to grieve because I was focused entirely on getting Quintana well. And I think that was, in a way, it was very good. Because by the time I was able to deal with it, I was dealing with it not quite as a crazy person, which I certainly would have been at the beginning.
You had to deal with one thing that is a very, I think, peculiar thing to have to deal with. When you're grieving for the loss of a child, you had to figure out, well, did you have to rewrite or update your book? You know, your memoir had just been sent in.
Your daughter never crossed my
mind. Never crossed your mind to rewrite it?
No.
But why not?
It was finished. Well, it was about a certain period of time after John died, and that period was over. If I were to do something about Quintana, which I have no thought of doing, it would be a different book. It would be a thing of its own. It wouldn't be about a marriage. This book is about a marriage.
Things like deaths and and other tragedies tend to test people's faith if they have it, or get them to immerse themselves deeper into faith, or affirm their lack of faith, or have them change from one point of view to another. I don't know if you've ever had any faith, and if at all the deaths of your daughter and husband affected that.
No, the deaths of my daughter and husband did not affect it. Whether I've had any faith is, I have a kind of faith, but it's not a conventional kind of faith. And as I said someplace in the book, that I believed in geology and in the Episcopal litany, but I believe in certain symbols, but I don't believe in them as literal truth. I believe in a poetic truth.
Do you have any? What is death to you? I mean, when you think about death, do you think of there being some kind of afterlife, or just, you know, like a void or a soul? Or
no, I don't believe in an afterlife. Well, what is death to me? Death is ashes to ashes, dust to dust. Yeah, there's a continuum, of things, but I don't believe in it. I remember somebody once saying to me, the manager of a motel where I was staying, I was doing a piece in Oregon, and this motel manager had just come back from a funeral, and he said it was the most depressing thing he'd ever been to. He said, it's the coldest funeral I've ever been to. It was an Episcopalian funeral. Have you ever been to one? I said, yes, I had. And he said, they are so cold. And I said, how do you mean? And he said, if you can't believe you're going to heaven in your own body on a first name basis with everybody in your family, what's the point of dying? And I loved this. I mean, it was so far from any kind of church I knew, you know. I mean, the whole question, what's the point of dying? Well, yes, what is the point? I mean, there was a kind of madness about it. I mean, that's the faith I don't have.
Do you ever wish you did? Do you ever envy, like, that man, for instance, who has that kind of faith that, you know, he's going to die and be reunited in heaven,
and that
in his clothes, in his body?
Sure. That would be, I suppose, very comforting, but there's no possible way I could have it.
Are you feeling overwhelmed now by the fragility of life, having lost your daughter and husband?
Well, I certainly felt it after John died. Yes, I am a little on the wary side. A friend was having a sort of a minor procedure today, and I was very anxious. I found myself being far more anxious about it than I might normally have been.
Are you any more or less worried about your own death now?
No, I'm not worried about my own death. I think I'm less worried.
Why?
One of the things that worries us about dying always is we think we're afraid we're leaving people behind, and they won't be able to take care of themselves. We have to take care of them. But in fact, you see, I'm not leaving anybody behind. This is an area we shouldn't get into, I think.
That's fine. Do you want another minute before we talk more?
Yes.
Yeah. We're listening to the conversation I recorded yesterday with Joan Didion. While we paused for a moment, my producer told me that this year's National Book Award nominees had just been announced. Then we continued the interview. While you were just collecting your thoughts for a second, my producer just came in and said, and I don't know if you know this or not, but it just came across the wire that your memoir was nominated for a National Book Award.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, well, great.
So I guess let me be the first to congratulate you.
Well, thank you. Thank you.
What a weird time for you. The book, yeah. I understand, is like flying off the shelves. It's nominated for a National Book Award, and it's about the worst thing that's ever happened to you in your life.
Yeah. There is a mixed feeling about it, I mean, in my mind. On the other hand, it would make John happy.
Oh,
I think he'd be very gratified.
I know that, among other things, your book will be read by a lot of people who have, you know, gone through their own grief. What were some of the things that you've read that you found helpful? You know, one of the things that really surprised me, actually, in your book is that you single out Emily Post. You went back
Emily Post was fantastic on the whole subject of death and how to handle people who are who are grieving. I mean, she's so practical. She simply dealt with what happens to them physiologically. They're cold. They're going to be cold. They're going to need, their digestion is going to stop. Everything stops. Everything in your body just stops when you're going through something like that. And so she suggested little ways to get them back to life. Have them sit by the fire. The room should be sunny. They can be served small amounts of toast or something they like, but not much, because they will reject it. You can sort of, if you just hand them something when they come home from the funeral, you will find that they eat it. But if you ask them, they will say no. Actually, Knopf got a letter from her, from one of her descendants, who now edits the cookbook or the etiquette book. And she pointed out that this, the 1922 edition, which is the edition I was reading, had been written not long after the death of Emily Post's son. And almost everybody in that period had somebody die close to them. I mean, we were dealing with the aftermath of the 1918 flu epidemic. People died of infections. I mean, death was really in every household. So it was a much more commonly acknowledged thing than it is now. I mean, now when it happens in hospitals, we tend to think of it as the province of doctors. Well, at that time, everybody knew somebody who was in mourning.
Before we say goodbye, I'm just wondering, I felt a little uncomfortable during this interview, only because the memoir is such a fine book, and I think your losses are still so recent. I feel awkward talking with you about them, and I imagine it must be awkward for you to be talking about it to people you don't know, like me, and to our listeners. At the same time, I understand that there might be some comfort in that, because one of the things you've always been as a writer is a reporter, not a reporter in the conventional sense, but as a more poetic form of reporter who observes the things around you in the world and reports on that for the rest of us. Do you feel like that's what you're doing now?
Well, I think I had a very definite sense of reporting when I was doing this book, and I don't mean reporting, doing the research. There was a certain amount of research I did. I mean, I did some reading about grief. I mean, I read all the psychiatrists. A sense of reporting from a different, from a state that not everybody had yet entered. I mean, or that some people had but hadn't reported back. I thought there might be some use in reporting back, in sending a dispatch, in filing.
Well, Joan Didion, I'm glad that you decided to actually write this book, and I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Joan Didion's new memoir is called The Year of Magical Thinking. You can read an excerpt on our website, freshair.npr.org.